Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome you all to the courtroom today, but we're especially delighted to welcome some students from Gateway Technical College. Would they please stand? They've managed to get here today. Well, thank you for coming, especially in this spring weather. You may be seated. We have summaries of the case you're about to hear, so it makes it more interesting to listen to the case if you're more familiar with it. So if someone would like a summary of the case, if you'd raise your hand, the marshal will distribute a summary. Okay. We've introduced our students today. Let me introduce the court to you all. Seated in my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. She is the justice who will conduct a session with the students at noon for those students and anyone else who'd like to attend. The session will discuss the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of any of the cases we hear this morning. Seated next to Justice Bradley is Justice David Prosser. And on the far left is Justice Lewis Butler. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice, and to my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. To his right, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Patience Rogensack. With those introductions made, I'll now call our first case this morning, 2005 AP 2837, Trinity Petroleum, Inc. versus Scott Oil Company, Inc. Arguing on behalf of Scott Oil Company is Juan S. Ramirez. Attorney Ramirez, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Juan Ramirez appearing on behalf of defendant, appellant petitioner Scott Oil Company. Along with me today at counsel's table is Aaron Castens of Michael Best and Friedrich. Counsel. Your Honors, this case is about doing right to the victim of a frivolous lawsuit, Scott Oil. In adopting the 1993 amendments to Rule 11, this Court stated that it did not intend to deprive a party wronged by frivolous conduct of the right to recovery. Simply put, this Court did not intend to let perpetrators of frivolous actions go unpunished and leave the victimized parties uncompensated. We're here today because the very result that this Court sought to prevent has occurred. Scott Oil has been forced to bear the full cost of this undisputedly frivolous lawsuit while the offending party has been relieved of any responsibility for its conduct. This Court has an opportunity today to right this wrong, to punish Trinity and its counsel for conduct that they have never disputed as frivolous, and to compensate the innocent party in this action. We submit that the only just result in this case is to conclude that the action is governed under repealed statute Wisconsin Section 814.025. This was the statute that was in force during the time of the frivolous conduct, and this conclusion does not vary depending on whether this Court concludes that the old Section 814.025 was a substantive statute or whether the new rule, 80205, is procedural. There's no dispute among the parties that retroactive application of the new rule operated to the disadvantage of the innocent party and this victim, Scott Oil Company, who consistently and justifiably relied on Section 814.025. In fact, all parties, when this litigation commenced and was prosecuted, understood that they were bound to the then existing law. There's also no dispute that Scott Oil put Trinity on notice and specifically requested its fees under the old law while those statutes were in force.
Let me talk about that for a minute. Tell me about the timelines you're talking about when you say you put them on notice. In other words, here you have, there was a motion for summary judgment. I know there was, let's say you started this, okay, in 2004, and the summary judgment was moved April 5th, 2005, which was that 4 days after the new rule went into effect?
Your Honor,
I just want to just kind of get that in my mind, because you're talking about that the party's new and you're proceeding under the old, the former statute, 814.2025.
Your Honor, first, Scott Oil was the defendant in this action. This lawsuit, as you indicated, was filed in 2004. The notices that Scott Oil believed this lawsuit was frivolous occurred under the backdrop of a discovery dispute. Scott Oil had submitted several discovery requests in December. By the time the mediation was ordered by the judge in this case, we're talking about March of 2005. We submitted a mediation statement where we made clear that we thought the lawsuit was frivolous. Trinity had not turned over any documents, and we had long suspected that Trinity could not prevail under its own theory of the case. In April of 2005, Scott Oil responded to a motion to quash our motion to compel. And in our response to that motion, Scott Oil specifically addressed the issue of frivolousness.
So that's where it was first addressed and when?
It was first addressed in March, but that's correct. In April, we addressed it. We addressed it again in our pretrial report where we put the court on notice that we thought the lawsuit was frivolous. We also addressed it in our response to Trinity's motion to quash and deny our motion for summary judgment, in which we specifically cited 80205 when that statute was in force. We also specifically cited the fact that we felt that Trinity had substantial documentation in its possession indicating that they could not prevail under their own theory. And we took it a step further. We specifically cited in the body of the brief that we thought this lawsuit was frivolous, and we specifically referred to the frivolousness statute 814.025, specifically, again, requesting relief under that section. A hearing was held on the motion to compel in May of 2005, again, while those statutes were in force.
Why didn't you file a motion for frivolous during any of those times?
Your Honor, in 2005, Scott Oil was proceeding under the existing jurisprudence covering this action. As you know, the Jandert decision was still good law, and we submit that the policies underpinning the Jandert decision is still in force in light of the repeal. There was no statutory requirement to provide safe harbor. In fact, that's what's before this Court today. The law dramatically changed. Under Jandert, a party could wait until the conclusion of the litigation. That's exactly what happened in Jandert. The case was dismissed, and a motion for
File a motion. That's right. They could wait.
Yes.
Did you contemplate filing a motion? I mean, it seems to me you start out saying we had long suspected that Trinity could not prevail under their theory, and then you just detailed in March you mentioned it in your mediation statement, in April you mentioned in your pretrial statement, in April you mentioned it in your brief, and in May, if I recall, there's also on your oral motion on your hearing the dispute regarding discovery.
Your Honor, we specifically pled frivolousness under the statute and under our rules of civil procedure in this state. We submit that we did move the court. Under 80201, our statute dictates how motions are made. Motions are made in writing unless they're done at a hearing. We did it in writing, we did it in pleadings, and we also submitted that motion again at the conclusion of the motion to compel hearing. In fact, if you look at the record in this case, Judge Kiefer specifically addresses the fact that Scott Oil was indeed renewing its request. That request was made under the operative tenure of the repealed statutes.
And they were, okay, that's what I wanted to thank Justice Bradley for asking. I just wanted to know how the parties were phrasing their dialogue here. And so Scott and Trinity, particularly Trinity, was on notice that this was frivolous, and there was nothing that I could see in the record about any safe harbor or anything like that at that time.
That's correct, Your Honor. We did not provide the 21-day safe harbor, as that was not the existing law.
Because it was not done at that time.
But it was the existing law before the hearing on July 5. You could have asked for a continuance then, right? And given them 21 days. And that would have said, what would have that done?
Well, if we made a motion on July 1st, for example, the Court of Appeals and even Trinity concedes that there was virtually nothing from which they could have withdrawn post-judgment.
Well, but you don't have a judgment yet.
That's correct.
This is before summary judgment. So the court is, you still have a hearing. You have a motion for summary judgment. You have a hearing date scheduled. The hearing date is after the effective date of the new rules. And I'm saying, suppose you filed on July 1 your an appropriate motion under the new rule saying, hey, this is frivolous. You got 21 days to get out. Otherwise, we're going to ask for costs, attorney fees, and et cetera, whatever is allowed under the new rules. What would the result have been then?
The result would have been the same, Your Honor.
Aye.
The result would have been the same first. Before I get there, Your Honor, I'd like to just address the fact that this case was even heard in July. The summary judgment motion was actually scheduled to take place, or the hearing was scheduled to take place in June of 2006. It was through stalling discovery, and this court basically, it was just a matter of court scheduling. All the briefing had been done. We had moved the court under the existing statute, and I would argue that they had more like 120 days notice. So certainly they were on notice, and it's only because the court had to adjust its schedule to accommodate discovery, which we fought tooth and nail to get, that this hearing even took place in July.
Okay.
This case would have
That's life, you know. Things happen on particular dates for reasons that you don't have any control about. This was a transcript problem or something. Anyway, it was on the 5th. Suppose he had filed on the 1st.
If Your Honor is suggesting that we should have, on July 1st, provided 21 days' notice, there was simply no contention from which Trinity could withdraw. And I also want to say that, as an attorney, I have an ethical obligation to be a zealous advocate for my client. The only opportunity my client had to be fully compensated, and let's be clear, the existing and stated state policy under Jandert and its progeny is that compensation are among the policy considerations of 814.025. Had I moved under the new rule, my client may never have been able to be compensated after spending tens of thousands of dollars defending what is undisputedly a frivolous lawsuit.
Mr. Ramirez, was there any dispute at the summary judgment hearing? In other words, did Trinity file any affidavits or oppose the granting of summary judgment?
Your Honor, Trinity did oppose the granting of summary judgment, but they never once, not once, addressed our assertion that this lawsuit was frivolous. When you look
Can
at
you
the...
you say they opposed it. Did they file affidavits counter to your affidavits, or what did they do in opposition?
They filed an affidavit of its CEO, Mark Smith, and it goes to the underlying conduct in this action. I mean, we obtained a summary judgment after establishing that Trinity could not prevail under its own legal theories. And I think it's also noteworthy that the very basis that we stated that we were entitled to our fees is, in fact, the very basis upon which the trial court determined that this action was not grounded in law or in equity or did not have evidentiary support. And that is that Trinity had in its possession, prior to filing and during the prosecution of this case, substantial documentation that they were put on notice, and these are the trial court's words, they were put on notice that they should have discontinued this action. They didn't.
Counsel, I just want to make sure the record is correct on this. You just argued a moment ago that the hearing was scheduled in June of 06. I think you meant June of 05?
That's correct. Okay. That's correct. Thank you.
What is exactly the evidence that the other side delayed discovery or delayed the hearing?
There's no clear evidence that it took a motion to compel, and counsel filed there was a number of briefs that filed to move to quash that motion. Under our rules of civil procedure, you make a request for documentation. The rules require that you supply something within 30 days. It didn't happen. Trinity never gave that documentation. In fact, the discovery was 3 to 4 months late. Trinity has not contested the finding of frivolousness, incidentally. The motion was made under the The motion for our attorney's fees was made when those statutes were enforced. There's never been a challenge to the finding of frivolousness in this case.
Counsel, would you, your argument be the same? That is, that the prior version of 80205 should govern this case. If the hearing were held on July 20th rather than July 5th?
If the hearing was held on July 20th versus July 5th, I think, again, while we submit that the old statutes were, in fact, substantive in nature, I mean, in fact, when you look at what is a substantive statute, it's a rule of law or statute that defines, regulates, or creates a right. When that statute was repealed, a right was destroyed. We argued before this Court and the courts below that under our rules construing repealed statutes that you don't get a free pass. You simply don't.
Well, let me ask the question again. Would your argument be the same that the older version of 80205 should govern if the hearing here were on July 20th instead of July 5th?
Yes.
And would your argument be the same if the old version of 80205 should govern if the hearing here were held on August 21st rather than July 5th?
Yes. And
now, okay, so is there any end date? What if it were held on November 19th? I'm going to skip and go to all the birthdays of my kids and see if I can get it the whole year. Now, if it were held on November 19th, would your argument be the same?
Our argument is that the outcome does not change whether this Court determines that the new rule is procedural and therefore given a presumption of retroactivity.
Okay. I prefaced my question. If your argument would be the same, that the old version of 80205 should govern, if the hearing were held on November 19, 2005, rather than July 5th?
Your Honor,
you've got a lot of arguments.
Yes, the answer is yes, but it's the old version of 80205 and 814025. After all, it's the continuation of this lawsuit after they were put on notice under the operative tenure of 814025 that this lawsuit did not have a basis in law or in equity. So the answer is yes.
Didn't they continue the lawsuit for 5 days from July 1st to July 5th under the new law?
Did they continue the lawsuit to the extent that there was still further proceedings? The answer is absolutely. They did continue the lawsuit.
I mean, your argument is that they maintained this lawsuit frivolously, right?
That is correct. There was never a withdrawal of
Isn't your argument, unless I misunderstood it, that it was frivolous to file it in the first instance?
That's the trial court's conclusion, Your Honor, and it's never been challenged.
Right. And if that's the trial court's conclusion, that occurred long before July 1st, correct?
No, Your Honor.
I'm talking about the filing of the lawsuit. I want you to look at the conduct.
Your Honor is correct.
Okay. So I think what Justice Bradley is trying to understand is, are you arguing whether the continuation of the lawsuit, which is ongoing conduct after July 1st, is the gravamen of what you're arguing to us, or is it the initial filing, again, conduct that occurred well before the change in the law? And I guess I'd like to know, too, what are you arguing to us about?
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, we certainly move the court under both of the old or prior versions of the statute. The trial court concluded that this lawsuit was frivolous from the day of filing.
If it was frivolous, why did you spend so much time, energy, and money on it? And why didn't you just go right on in and make them prove their case to the court in terms of frivolousness? I never understand. If it's so frivolous, what are you guys doing? Frivolous is supposed to be obvious on the face of it, on initiation. I can understand saying it's frivolous after you've done discovery and you say, hey, there's nothing to this. I mean, I can understand that. But I can't understand when you say you look at the face of this complaint and it's frivolous. It was frivolous on initiation.
The key point in Your Honor's question is after you've had discovery. Discovery wasn't completed until May 27. We had a hearing scheduled for June under the old law.
So
discovery wasn't completed.
So why was it frivolous on initiation if it takes so long to figure out that it was frivolous on discovery?
Because it was upon discovery and after depositions had taken place that it became crystal clear that they had all along information that made this lawsuit a frivolous lawsuit. So it's upon the conclusion of discovery that all of this information rendered this, at least to us, made this clear, and that finding was supported by the trial court.
So you're telling me the plaintiff has to have specific, you can't prove frivolousness without showing that the plaintiff had to have known it was frivolous? Is that the standard?
The standard is that, and the policy, which has not changed even with the enactment of the new rule, is that counsel and parties should bring lawsuits based in good faith to ensure that the litigation is grounded in existing law or warranted for a modification of existing law or have evidentiary support. There simply was no evidentiary support. That fact became crystal clear. I think to crystallize our position here, however, is that the only thing that is just and practical in this case is that prospective application of the new rule is warranted under the facts of this case.
Counsel, if I can ask you about that, and I want to follow up specifically Justice Rogensack's and Justice Bradley's questions. What should our focus be? I know you're arguing for prospective application of the rule. Where should our focus lie? Yeah, should we be looking at when the frivolousness occurred or when the notice was given that you were dealing with a frivolous action? I was unclear of your position on that.
I think that with respect to, in light of the court's finding, which has not been challenged, the frivolousness, according to the trial court, began before this lawsuit was filed.
I understand that, but I'm trying to understand your argument. Do we focus on when the frivolous, from your position, from when the frivolousness occurred, or do we focus on when you gave opposing counsel notice that you were dealing with a frivolous action? What should be our point of reference?
I think the point of reference for the determination of the appropriate amount of sanctions should go to when the trial court concluded that this lawsuit was frivolous. However, it is also for the court to determine whether the appropriate attorney's fees should flow from the time that we put Trinity on notice. I think the correct answer here is that Trinity had an obligation, regardless of notions of notice, to make sure that a reasonable inquiry was made before it filed this lawsuit.
Counsel, I'm pulling the file. This is such a thick file. I don't know if I really want to look at it, so I'll just ask the question instead. Your brief, second paragraph of your brief, says that your motion, and that's what I was going to look at the stack of, your motion was arguing that Trinity maintained a lawsuit that lacked any basis in fact or law. Is that indeed what your motion was on July 5th, as you purported to be on page 4, or was it something else? Was it something other than what you have here? You say in your third sentence of your brief, at the hearing, Scott Oil's counsel orally renewed its motion for attorney's fees pursuant to Wisconsin's frivolousness statute 80205 and 814025, arguing that Trinity maintained a lawsuit that lacked any basis in fact or law.
Our motion was predicated upon both statutes. In fact, if you look to Jandert, although the court found that the commencement of the action was not frivolousness, the court certainly concluded that sanctions were warranted for the continuation.
For the maintaining of the lawsuit.
For maintaining the lawsuit. Our motion was predicated upon both of the repealed statutes.
So when you have in your brief, and that's what I was focusing on, because I didn't look in the record to actually see what your motion said, when you said that you were arguing that Trinity maintained a lawsuit that lacked any basis. The motion itself will actually reflect that the basis of the written motion will reflect that the basis of your motion was both that it initiated and continued it?
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Ramirez, this change is certainly inspired in part by Federal Rule 11, Civil Procedure, and the comments are there, not necessarily adopted. If we were to carefully scrutinize Federal Rule 11 and the experience under it, how, if at all, would that be helpful to our decision?
Your Honor, the stated policy of this state is that while deterrence is among the purposes underpinning these rules, in Wisconsin, at least under Jandert, and nothing has abrogated the holding in Jandert, that the notion of compensating or making the victim whole is not inconsistent with the concept of deterrence. And I think that in this case, and if you look at federal case law, while this court did not adopt the comments to the the federal note, it did put into the new rule its own comments. And in among those comments was that this court did not intend to deprive a party wronged by frivolous conduct of the right to recovery. Scott submits that this court chose its words carefully. It said the right to recovery, not the ability to recover. And here we have a party that has basically gone unpunished for an undisputedly frivolous lawsuit. If the court concludes, Your Honor, that indeed that this statute is procedural and the new rule should be is given a presumption of retroactive application, Scott Oil undertook a painstaking analysis and has rebutted the presumption of retroactivity. Scott Oil, first of all, met each one of the factors enumerated in Brown, State X. Rel. Brown v. Bradley. The first factor is, did the new rule announce a new principle of law, either by overruling clear or past precedent? The Court of Appeals concluded that this was a case of first impression. This law dramatically changed. It rendered a statute that was previously a mandatory award of attorney's fees and rendered that permissive. It also changed in another significant way. It required 21-day safe harbor. When this lawsuit was being litigated, there was no requirement compelling Scott Oil to provide that 21-day safe harbor. Furthermore, the second factor was is rebutted. Will the retroactive application of the new rule further or retard the operation of the rule? We submitted that it would retard the operation of the rule, and there's authority for that. If you look to federal case law, there's a case out there that is significantly analogous to the facts at bar, and this is the Land decision. In that case, the parties commenced and maintained a lawsuit under the operative tenure of the pre-1993 amendment to Rule 11. All the parties to that litigation understood that that was the law to which they were bound. There was a change in the law, but what was significant is the offending party or the violator in that case had been put on notice under the old law, and the court concluded in that decision that application of the amendment or the change where the law was once mandatory and made permissive would not be just and practicable for the purpose of the Supreme Court order. It would not be just and practicable to apply a new rule to long pending litigation. I think it's noteworthy that neither Amicus nor Trinity cite Land. It's the most analogous decision out there. But we have something better. We have this Court of Appeals decision in Brown. And Brown clearly holds that, Your Honor, I see my time is up.
That's okay. If you, I'm sorry.
Finish your sentence.
I was just going to say, if you want to extol the virtues of Brown, take all the time you, I mean, take all the time you want since I wrote it, but I'll defer to the Chief's comment.
You may finish your
thought. As I was saying, the very, very well-reasoned opinion in Brown is that retroactive application of a procedural rule is not absolute. And while you may disagree with our position that 814.025 did govern a substantive right, the outcome does not change if you conclude otherwise. That is, that it's a procedural rule because we've rebutted the presumption. The record is devoid of any instance where Trinity has challenged the fact that we have, under our jurisprudence, rebutted the presumption of retroactivity. The other factor in Brown is whether or not retroactive application of the new rule would lead to an inequitable result.
I was just kidding.
All right. Counsel, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for Trinity Petroleum, Douglas W. Rose. Attorney Rose.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. I'm Douglas Rose. I am representing the plaintiff respondent, Trinity Petroleum. I'd like to start with a little bit of rebuttal to Mr. Ramirez's arguments and then get into the substance of our position. First of all, I think it's important there was some discussion about delay in this date of July 5th and the hearing date. And the clear statement, I think in response to a question from Justice Bradley, was that it was somehow Trinity's fault that there was a delay. It was a discovery dispute. It's a continuation of problems caused by Trinity. If you look at record number 39 in the appendix 245, there's a letter, and that's to Judge Kiefer. And it's dated May 27th of 2005. And it says, this letter is to confirm a phone call with your clerk today. Both parties have proceeded with depositions. It goes on to state, by mutual agreement of counsel, we are thus requesting that the briefing schedule be changed and indicating a request for a new hearing date. Both counsel. Your clerk, Heidi, has indicated this would be an appropriate means to document this, signed by myself with a copy to Mr. Ramirez.
Counsel, notwithstanding the any concern about delay, what is your client's position? Are you saying this is not frivolous or it has not been frivolous based on the fact that there was this discovery and the fact that there was the contract between yourselves and Scott Oil? What's your position?
Sure. First of all, let me state my client's position, then let me state what I think Judge Kiefer determined and whether there truly was any finding of this case being frivolous. I don't think there was. My client's position is twofold. I think there are two issues. One is termination for cause. All right? And I think that goes to the initiation of the lawsuit. If you look at the very contract and you look at paragraph 17 of the contract, it talks about termination for cause. And it's handwritten and changed by the parties, and it says, it used to be before the hand wrote it, saying to the satisfaction of the various people, some other language. Then it says, changed by Scott Oil, and customer satisfaction.
Yeah, but wasn't it agreed? Are you saying that now that the contract was somewhat invalid? Is that?
No. No. I'm saying that that term in the contract, termination for cause, is up to the intent of the parties to determine. And that was one of the key issues in the case.
Okay. So when your opposing counsel indicated and the Chief Justice said, well, why didn't you, if you knew this was frivolous right at the outset, why didn't you assert yourself? Why did you have to go through discovery? Your opposing counsel said, well, we needed discovery to find out whether or not certain things were that were alleged were true. And he asserted that they needed that discovery.
On the first issue, how you do the contract interpretation, there's no discovery needed. The contract is right there. Everybody has it. Everyone can look at it at the initiation of the lawsuit. The initial question at the initiation, we had different positions. My position was that that was unclear. My client says that...
So you're up here arguing that there still are issues and we're not arguing about frivolousness. Is that correct?
No, because I think the issue as well defined for the court today... It doesn't have to do with that. We're assuming that just for the sake of argument. But I do not believe that Judge Kiefer found that. I'm looking at his decision. I'm looking at his decision on page 40. This is in the appendix 65. He first of all, spends a lot of time talking about exactly what we're here today for. And that issue, we have retroactive application of 80205 and whether or not they actually discovered that that statute had actually been repealed and renewed. And he says... At the end, he finds that their claim that this lawsuit is frivolous is without merit, period. And then he says, now let me make some other comments. And he goes on and makes other comments. Look, if you look at Jandert, in Jandert, the circuit court judge, the trial judge, made 100 and some findings of fact and 84 conclusions of law. If you look at Judge Kiefer's oral decision here, he makes absolutely no findings of fact. And if you look at the case law, it's required, even under 814.025 and under the old 80205, it's required for a judge, if they're going to make a finding that a case is frivolous, for them to analyze the case, for them to make findings of fact. If you look at Judge Kiefer's decision, he says nothing like that.
And if I'm looking at page 69 of the appendix from the oral decision and just quoting what Judge Kiefer said, I believe that, in summary, if we were using the old law under 802.05 and 814.025, that this was not an action that was well-grounded in fact or law. However, I believe that under the new standard we utilize in this case, under the new 802.05, that procedurally this was not followed. The safe harbor provisions were not given.
Okay, very, very good point. I'm right there with you, I believe. If you look at the previous page, page 43, he says, I then turn to whether the position taken by Trinity on the objective versus subjective standard, and that's the point I'm talking about when we say the initiation of the lawsuit. We consider it to be an objective standard. This is similar to a Wisconsin Fair Dealership Law case. My client put a lot of time and energy into this contract and money into doing this work. That they could argue asking for some change in Wisconsin law or an extension of Wisconsin law, I guess that might be somewhat arguable. He goes on in the next paragraph. Could that carry weight with a different court? Possibly. Then he goes on page 44. Along with the multitude of documents that they got, clearly showing dissatisfaction, that there was probably more than ample material. There are more caveats than there are conclusions here. And he certainly doesn't come to any finding of fact about any particular issue. Going back to Justice Wilcox's comments, and I think you picked up on it, the objective versus subjective standard, that's one of the defenses on the initiation of the lawsuit. We certainly think the contract is subject to reasonable different interpretations. Second, when he talks about the documents received, we had 19 million gallons of fuel oil delivered, 19 million, significantly less than 1% showed any dissatisfaction. And, yes, of course there were affidavits filed in response to the motion for summary judgment. And my client says the bulk of those customer complaints had to do with the fact that it wasn't anything that Trinity did wrong. They weren't able to get the fuel oil from the depot. Yes, there's a factual dispute there. And, unfortunately, for all concerned, as we're sitting here, if we're going to argue the merits, Judge Kiefer never made any findings of fact on that. And, therefore, we don't have a finding of frivolousness. I don't want to spend too much time on that because I don't think that's the issue before the court. You can tell from my brief, as irritating as it was to not argue that, we've got to focus on the issue before the court. And I think that is a very substantive, good, philosophical issue for people to determine, for you all to determine.
Can I ask you a question? I understood from your opponent's argument that there had been a hearing scheduled in June of 2005?
That is true.
Suppose that hearing had been held. Suppose the court had found that you didn't have a good basis in fact or law for your lawsuit, or certainly for maintaining the lawsuit. What law should have applied?
I think as of that point in time, because the effective date of 802.05 was not until July 1st, even though it was enacted on March 1st of 2005, I would have to admit that at that point in time, the judge would have had to hold a hearing, the judge would have had to make findings of fact, and had to have reached conclusions of law under that statute, whether or not it was frivolous. He didn't do that. I feel rather confident that he wouldn't have found, ultimately, after having done the proper hearing and made true findings of fact, not just a dicta comment, I think he would have found in our favor. That didn't happen. He never got to that issue, and you can tell from his decision he never got to that issue. He says the very first thing, he spends pages and pages saying, here is why I never get to that issue. And I don't get to that issue because the motion you filed cites the old 802.05.
Counselor, I'd like you to address section 990.04 for me. And how it might relate to a right that was available under 814.025 before we repealed it on July 1st.
990 deals with inchoate rights, which don't accrue until someone has a judgment. I think the Court of Appeals analysis, citing the Waddell, W-A-D-D-E-L-L case, and also the Neeson case, Neeson versus State, I think is absolutely correct. I think that issue is a relatively straightforward one. In the amicus brief filed by the Wisconsin Academy of Trial Lawyers, they totally agree with that. Yes, if, and it's an absolutely huge if, if we were to the point where they had a judgment, if they had a substantive right already given to them, already something of substance that they had in hand.
Is it your position, then, that 814.025 gives no substantive right, so they had no substantive right prior to the change in the statute?
Yes, and I think that's exactly the point that I think is most problematic for the Court, and I'd like to segue into it if I could. If, let's start with this, all right? The premise has to be, if procedural, the statute is given retroactive effect. I think that's the general premise we're all dealing with here.
Well, that's 802.05. I'm asking you about 814.025, different statute.
The problem is, if you claim that 814.025 is a substantive statute giving substantive rights and therefore it's not in code under 90.04, the promulgation of the new rule 802.05 by this Court is unconstitutional. I think that's what Justice Wilcox actually argued in his dissent to the promulgation of this rule. And quite candidly, what a morass that puts us in. If you rule in this case, as they're arguing, that they had a substantive right, you are essentially ruling that this Court's promulgation of the new 802.05 was unconstitutional.
Could I go back?
I believe.
I go back to my question. If there had been a hearing in June of 2005 and the Court had found that the suit was frivolous, what would the judge have done?
I don't know. I would be speculating. He didn't indicate in his decision what he would have done. He obviously didn't sua sponte say that this was...
Let me ask this. What is the statute, 814.025, said that he should have done?
Well, 814.025 regarding continuing an action after a reasonable person would conclude that it would be frivolous to continue the action does require sanctions.
It requires sanctions?
It does require sanctions, yes.
I suppose he didn't impose any sanctions at all. I find this is frivolous, but I'm not imposing a sanction. What would happen then?
I believe under the old rule, 814.025, the wording in the statute is shall. But then the determination, and there's case law that also says you have to consider equitable determinations of what those sanctions should be. The initial answer to your question is there'd have to be some sort of sanction because it says shall. The second answer to your question is exactly what that would be, what are the equitable considerations, looking at all sorts of factors that he has to look at, as shown in Jandert, findings of fact, conclusions of law, reasonable analysis. We have to look at, for example, what did my client tell me? We have to look at could reasonable people differ? What was the complexity of the case? There's all sorts of factors that we have to look at, which we never got to.
Suppose the judge didn't impose any sanctions at all after finding frivolous.
I have to admit, I think that would have been a question that could have gone up on appeal. I think he would have made a mistake if he didn't do anything. Now, the case law says it can be a verbal reprimand. All right? Exactly what it is, I don't know. But if I'm taking your question literally and he says absolutely nothing for a sanction, I think that would be a problem under that hypothetical, Judge.
Do you think that your opponents would have had any right to appeal? What would they have argued?
I'm having trouble getting to that point of the hypothetical because, in my opinion, this wasn't a frivolous case at all. We made the decision not to appeal the summary judgment decision. Some cost-benefit analysis always has to occur here. We made the decision not to do that. But I can't help but speculate on that. I don't know what the Court of Appeals would have done or what further appellate review would have resulted in. I don't know. And I don't think anyone knows.
Are there any cases under Federal Rule 11 after it was changed in 1993,
right,
or perhaps after it was changed in the early 80s, that deal with the retroactivity of the rule?
Oh, sure. I think it's very clear under the federal court cases, and the amicus brief filed by Waddell has a very good section on that that says that Wisconsin doesn't have an awful lot of case law on that, but under the federal rule, which is analogous, it's very clear that if you find the new 802.05 or Rule 11, it is procedural, and therefore it should have retroactive effect for that reason. There's a lot of case law regarding
every case?
The defense argues that there are some cases, for example, the estate of Brown versus Bradley, that talks about situations where there are buts to the retroactive effect. If you look at, and I'd like to talk about Brown, I don't think it's on point here at all. The ultimate conclusion in that case was that we had similarly situated prisoners, and that was the reason the court ultimately decided it shouldn't have retroactive effect, that we have similarly situated prisoners who should have a mailing rule because, quite candidly, the jails weren't forwarding their petitions for review. A very different case, dealing with criminal law, not dealing with a rule or a statute, but dealing with a judicial decision. Yes, there are some cases under Rule 11 that have some caveats to the principle that a rule of procedure should have retroactive effect, but they're very few and far between. And, for example, Brown, I don't think it's on point at all.
Counselor, if you go back and look at the comment to the majority of this Court's decision to repeal 814.025 and then 802.05 and recreate those statutes within the new 802.05, in its statement that it did not intend to change any substantive right, isn't it possible that 802.05 in its new form is substantive if 814.025 had substantive components or the old 802.05 had substantive components?
I don't think so based on the other comments. The Supreme Court order 0306, it states, pursuant to its authority under 751.12 of the statutes, if it's a substantive right, you don't have the authority.
That's only if you repeal it. That statute, as I recall, talks about changing and removing a substantive right. But if, in fact, you just transport it into a different statute, isn't it arguable that it hasn't been changed? It's still there. It's just in a different statute.
I think the whole key here is the, again, and let me continue with the language of the rule, whether it's substantive or procedural, pursuant to its authority under 751.12, to regulate pleading, practice, and procedure in judicial proceedings. That's what you said when you promulgated the new rule. And you also said the court's intent, what is the court's intent when you promulgated the new rule, is to simplify and harmonize the rules of pleading, practice, and procedure. That's
the
intent.
You also said in our comment that we were not intending to change any substantive right. And under 751.12.1, it said the rules shall not abridge, enlarge, or modify the substantive rights of the litigant. But if we didn't intend to do that, isn't it possible that the new 802.05 has substantive components?
If as you're indicating, I still fall back on the dilemma for the court as we sit here today, that if your comment is correct, that really by putting in a new 802.05, you did something substantive and changed some substantive rights.
No, I'm saying we didn't change it. We just put it in another statute. We said we had no intention, that's what our comment says, to change a substantive right. So if we didn't have any intent to do that, and if operating under the statute that we conducted the repeal under prevents us from doing that, then why isn't there a substantive right in the new 802.05?
I'll take it back to the Jandert case, okay?
Okay.
In Jandert, even though there's been a lot of comment to the contrary, Jandert states unequivocally that the fundamental purpose of saying a procedural statute should have retroactive effect is because the purpose of it is to deter. And if you agree with Jandert, which is interpreting the old 802.05 and 814.025, and it says the purpose is to deter, that's not a substantive right, that's a procedural right. So therefore, the old 802.05 and 814.025 are procedural, just like the new 802.05.
And
they did not provide substantive rights. They were regulating procedure. And that's why the comment occurs. You know, because we made this change, we don't consider it to be a substantive change. That's not our intent to make a substantive change. We're making a change in rules of procedure. I think it is consistent. I think the comment does make sense when you look at it in that light, that the comment was made because we have, we're making this change. We believe that we have the authority to make this change. And we believe that the old statutes are procedural. We believe the new statute is procedural. And therefore, we're not taking away anyone's substantive rights. And that's why we come to the ultimate conclusion here that when counsel Scott Oyle did not lose any substantive rights, and they could have followed up and done an appropriate motion under 802.05 and done the safe harbor. We're forgetting all sorts of things, saying that the die was cast, everything was done. No, it's not. We're still here on this case. We're still having appeals. There can be motions for reconsideration. Litigation does not end the day that there's a summary judgment hearing. I think that's disingenuous as well.
I'm concerned that, and it's sort of a kind of follow-up to Justice Prosser, if this had all happened before July 1, you'd be under the old rules, right? Because the effective date is
July
1, and it's hard to say the court intended it to be effective beforehand. I mean, counsel can argue anything, but that's not persuasive.
I would agree.
Okay. So now we have it lopped over by 5 days. The question is, should you apply, let us assume, for the purpose of my question, that this was a perfectly acceptable procedural rule change. And it's effective July 1. Now you've got a hearing after July 1, but the whole case has really preceded July 1. And let us suppose your opponent had filed on July 1 a motion giving you 21 days to withdraw, right? And suppose you didn't withdraw, and now you're going into the summary judgment motion and you're opposing it. Under those circumstances, do you think that, and if the judge found against you, what would your position be then?
Yeah, I think I follow you. That's a lot of ifs along the way.
Sure.
So that makes it difficult.
I'm setting up my own case.
I understand. But if I give all those ifs and take all those hypotheticals, and if the motion had been filed timely,
right,
and if everything had been done in that regard, and we hadn't withdrawn our position.
Had not withdrawn.
Had not withdrawn, had not taken that safe harbor provision and said, okay, you convinced us, we'll withdraw. Well, then I think if Judge Kiefer determined ultimately that it was not well-grounded, we'd have sanctions.
The new statute, under the new rule.
As provided under the new rule. The new rule does not eliminate sanctions at all. I think that's why we're saying we're losing a substantive right, we're losing a substantive right. No, you're not. You just have a different procedure on how to get it.
Well, no, the new rule gives you the safe harbor. So if you're saying, I think the Chief said, I may have misconstrued what she had asked you, but you said you did not withdraw.
That's right.
So if you didn't withdraw, then you would be subject,
to sanctions.
Medical.
Yeah. Now is the point of my question. Now I have two other questions. One, it is, as I understand it, your position that the trial court never found frivolousness, either in initiation or maintenance of the suit.
Yes.
That's your position.
They made a comment regarding it, but they did not find it. You have to have findings of fact.
If the court should say you're wrong about which rule applies, then you think it should be remanded. Is that your position?
Yes,
or
it is.
Can we determine frivolousness here?
Oh, I don't think you can without an adequate record. You don't have findings of fact from the trial court, and you have to defer, according to the Jandert and other cases, you have to defer to the trial court for that.
Okay. My other question is, in the federal cases, they treat amendments, my question is, do they treat amendments to Rule 11, which is the frivolous rule, as procedural?
Amendments as well. Rule 11 was amended in 1993, mm-hmm. and there has been, and the cases that were cited in the Wisconsin Academy of Trial Lawyers amicus curiae brief relate cases that occurred after 1993 that talk about it being procedural. So I think the answer to that is a definite yes.
Well, if I can follow that question, What's your argument with respect to the Seventh Circuit decision, Land versus Chicago truck drivers, how that was applied?
Sure. One moment.
That's the case where the Court of Appeals indicated it would not follow the new Rule 11. In applying it shortly after the change.
Right. That's a Seventh Circuit case going back to 1994. I think there's a huge distinction from the Land case and this one. In the Land case, the motion was filed. We know that Rule 11 was revised in 1993. Okay? The motion in the Land case was filed, the motion to hold the other party and sanctions for it being frivolous was filed before the amendment. In other words, the facts in the Land case are similar to the hypothetical saying if Scott Oil had filed its motion to say that the plaintiff's claim was frivolous prior to the change in the law. It was only on appeal in the Land case. It was while the case was on appeal that the amendment to Federal Rule 11 went into effect. And the argument was made, I think, a pretty difficult argument to make. Well, now that we're on appeal, there's been a change in the law. Therefore, you should go back and say we should apply this new rule.
But if I understand opposing counsel's point, it's that under Jandert, this motion could have been made regarding frivolousness at any time during the course of the proceedings. So, that includes after the proceedings have concluded. So if that's their position, the law that existed in this case would have allowed for that filing after the fact, prior to the change in the law.
That's his position, but we respectfully disagree with it. Once July 1st, 2005 occurred, okay, there is a new procedural rule. And I'm quite candidly looking at this case saying, isn't it also improper conduct for someone to file a motion with a particular statute and rule in effect as of that date and not even recognize it's there? The truth is, in this case, it was filed after the effective date. The motion was filed after the effective date, which is an absolutely huge distinction from the Land case.
When was the motion filed?
The motion was filed July 5th of 2005, and the brief was filed on July 20th of 2005.
This is a motion for frivolous costs.
Yes, and that occurred after the court's hearing and after the summary judgment. I think it's also worth noting in that regard that they claimed that they made all these motions that say it was frivolous, et cetera. In the summary judgment filing, there was no motion for summary judgment. We have local rules that require motions to have notices, to be in writing, to have hearing dates. There was no formal motion. It was put in the prayer for relief saying we think summary judgment, plus we'd like to have some costs for it being frivolous. It's put in a prayer.
Mr. Rose, I have here the annotations of the United States Code for Federal Rule 11, Civil Procedure. And one of the cases, and I haven't read the case, but it says, whether conduct should be sanctioned is measured by standard in effect at time of conduct to be sanctioned. That would seem to say that the new rule is prospective. This is a 1995 case. And then the following case basically has the same principle, the next one cited. What's your response to that?
Well, we have to go back to the time the conduct occurred to determine if at that time the conduct was frivolous or not. For example, there can be changes in the law. I don't necessarily disagree with that comment. If I am in 1995 and I'm presenting a case and the economic loss doctrine hasn't occurred yet, well, I have to be judged on my conduct at that time. If it's up on appeal 5 years later and the economic loss doctrine, a case which I was here once before, changed, which it certainly did a number of different times, well, then you have to judge the conduct in light of the point in time that it occurred. I don't think that changes the fact that this is a procedural statute and that we have to follow the procedure in effect at the time. I'm sorry, Justice Bradley.
No, I'm sorry. Please finish.
I believe I am. Yeah.
You've made reference a couple of times to the amicus brief filed here today. Mm-hmm. And it,
it emphasizes in page 9 of the brief the unique circumstances of this case. And I get it, I guess, with a little frustration, because I think this case is very unique. Unique in that you have a law, or you had a rule that went into effect on July 1, and then judgment granted, case over on July 5th. I think that if this case, summary judgment were granted on July 19th rather than July 5th, I think very different arguments would be made, and perhaps even Wattle's ultimate position would be different. It seems to me that they are ultimately arguing under the unique circumstances of this case, where there is an where it's after the effective date, but an impossibility to give 21 days notice, and they italicize under the unique circumstances of this case. You know, maybe it should be a result different than what you're advocating. I'm just wondering how many cases we have on appeal that summary judgment was that involved frivolousness, and that summary judgment was granted within the first 21 days of July. In other words, I'm wondering how unique this case is, and I'm concerned that's exceedingly unique, and I'm just sitting here as a trial court judge rather than an appellate court judge. Do you have any response?
Well, sure. Let's start with this. The case was filed in April of 2004. Okay? Counsel made a lot of a point in the briefs and in argument about discovery delays. There was a 160-day discovery delay from our discovery to the responses. There was plenty of opportunity, if they wanted, to file a motion saying it was frivolous under the old rules earlier, number one. Number two, you know, it's an old adage, but it does apply. Hard cases make bad law. And if you decide that this case somehow, because of a 5-day difference or a 10-day difference, and I think your point was good earlier, what if it was 3 months later or 2 months earlier? We can have hypotheticals all day long. But what are we going to do? Are we going to create a morass out there that says, okay, if it was 3 days, then it's different. If it's a month, it's different. And then we have another litigable issue, and we all waste the court's time? That's exactly contrary to the purpose. The purpose was to streamline the procedural rules and get some judicial efficiency into the courts. It would totally defeat that purpose of Supreme Court Order 0306. I believe I'm out of time. Thank you, Judge.
Ms. Rose, thank you for your argument. We will have a rebuttal on Mr. Ramirez.
Your Honors, we're not here to relitigate this case. Trinity has not challenged the Court's finding that this lawsuit was frivolous. As I look at Judge Kiefer's ruling, as Justice Butler pointed out, the trial court concluded that if we're operating under the old law, this was a case that was not grounded in law or in fact. Frivolousness is not before this court. With respect to Justice Rogensack's point as to whether or not this is substantive versus procedural, I think Justice Rogensack hit on an important point. Under Chapter 751.12, the authority under which this court repealed this statute, I see nothing in that statute that precludes this court from concluding or changing a rule, assuming that the court properly exercises its constitutional authority to consider.
We've already said that.
Yes. To consider a new rule to be applied prospectively, or it's not inconceivable that a rule or a statute can have both a substantive and a procedural component. Counsel has no difficulty pointing out that amicus and this court looks to federal decisions for guidance. The Land decision is the case that's most analogous, yet it's not cited or argued by either side.
Doesn't it make a difference that the rule didn't go into effect until the case was already on appeal? That argument, distinguishing Land, has some resonance with me.
Your Honor, with respect to Land, the rule change was virtually the same. The rule changed from a mandatory statutory scheme to a permissive one. The rule changed while the case was still being litigated, albeit on appeal. And just as in Land, Scott Oil put the other party on notice. It did not provide safe harbor, and we submit that we were not required to, but it did put them on notice that they considered the lawsuit frivolous, and yet the court held that this would not be just and practicable to hold the litigants in that case to a different standard. Everybody proceeded in this case under the existing law at the time. Counsel also has no difficulty citing Jandert. There are important policy considerations that were not repealed. One of those is protecting the integrity of the courts. Another one of those policies, as expressed in Jandert, is the fact that this court, in addition to citing deterrence as the purpose of 814.025, stated that certainly deterrence and punishment of an attorney or a party who maintains a frivolous action is not inconsistent with fully compensating an opposing party for costs and attorney's fees required to defend an action. We embrace that view today. There is nothing in the record and there's nothing in the order that basically removes compensating the innocent victim of that has been wronged by a frivolous lawsuit. With respect to the issue of...
I may ask, if this court were to somehow find that the rule was basically prospective, not retroactive, would we have to send this back for other findings of fact by the trial court?
That's a great question, Your Honor. There are no factual disputes here. Trinity does not challenge any of the findings of the trial court. And the findings of the trial court was that, given the documentation that was before the court, there was no basis in, there was no evidentiary support for their position. The court also concluded that, as a matter of law, the contract was unambiguous. These are findings. And the court made a conclusion that, under the old law, this was a frivolous lawsuit, as indicated by the text that Justice Butler read.
So let me follow up Justice Prosser's question, because the portion of the transcript that I read earlier, the trial court seemed to indicate that the procedure under the safe harbor provisions were not given. And it reminded me when I read that, and this goes to opposing counsel's argument, we have in other cases, I'm thinking of Roberson as one, indicated, well, we don't have to reach issue A because you went on issue B. And so you have this finding here that we don't have safe harbor given, therefore, I'm not certain what the trial court meant. Was the trial court making a finding that this was frivolous, or was the trial court saying, look, whether it's frivolous or not, there's no safe harbor given here, so I can't go there?
It's our position that the trial court concluded that this was a frivolous lawsuit. With respect to the safe harbor, the trial court was referring to the new safe harbor requirement. But if you look at the federal case law with cases that have analogous... I see my time is up, Your Honor.
You may finish the question.
When you look at analogous case law, and again, both Amicus and Trinity have no problem citing federal case law, the Land decision stands for the proposition that there is no unequivocal or unbending application or retroactive application of a new rule. There's also another federal decision, the Nissenbaum case, in which we cited where there was substantial compliance with the notice requirement. Scott Oil put Trinity on notice early in this case that it considered its lawsuit frivolous. But the outcome doesn't change if this court concludes that it properly exercises constitutional authority and the new rule is indeed a procedural rule and therefore given a presumption of retroactivity. It doesn't change the outcome because Scott Oil has sufficiently rebutted the presumption of retroactivity. If it's procedural, prospective application is justified and warranted. If it's substantive, we still win. And another important policy, as espoused in Jandert, is unchanged. Again, safe harbor should not be a loophole through which litigants escape the responsibility for their conduct. Scott Oil has had to endure tens of thousands of dollars for what is undisputedly, and they don't dispute it. They could have briefed it, and they could have filed a cross appeal. They didn't.
Well, they didn't have to file a cross appeal, I don't think, because it would be in support of the Court of Appeals. I think the issue is whether they should have briefed that issue or not, and you obviously didn't have to raise it in your petition for review, and I don't think you did, as far as I remember.
Your point is well taken. Nevertheless, safe harbor is precisely the loophole that was used to escape sanctions in this case, and we're asking this Court.
The whole point of safe harbor is not to allow a frivolous pleader to escape. Purpose of safe harbor is to put the alleged frivolous pleader or maintainer of a suit on notice and give them the opportunity to get out, to save you a lot of money and time and effort, and save the Court the time and effort of determining frivolousness. That's the purpose of the safe harbor. So the question really in this lawsuit may very well be, was the purpose of the safe harbor provision fulfilled by your failure to give that notice? Or should you be excused from having given that notice because of the time factor here, the lopover of just 5 days, as I see it? And your response is,
my response
your client should win.
my response is they were given notice and they never withdrew.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Ramirez, and thank you, Mr. Rose, for your discussion of a very recent rule that obviously was significantly debated and disagreed upon amicably by this Court. So that concludes the hearing. In 2005, AP 2837, Trinity Petroleum, Inc. versus Scott Oil Company, Inc. Court will take a few moments of recess for those who wish to leave the courtroom. Hearing recess.